Welcome to Career Buzz, Canada's unique radio conversation that empowers lives, enriches careers, and energizes organizations. When's it time to move up, and when's it time to move out? And when's it time to adapt your style for greater success? Three big career questions today on Career Buzz. Hi, I'm Mark Franklin, practice leader of Career Cycles, a career management social enterprise. I'm pleased to be your host today on Career Buzz. Thanks for tuning in this morning. Move up, move out, or adapt your style. Bruce Hazen guides leaders and individuals to answer these questions as leader of Three Questions Consulting. His career story spans electronics, financial services, footwear, healthcare, legal, education, community services, engineering, and outplacement. Bruce Hazen joins us in the second part of today's show. But first, what are careers in the green economy? Brent Copperson is executive director of Windfall Ecology Center, a nonprofit social enterprise focused on building sustainable communities. Brent's career story includes 10 years leading an entertainment merchandising company before a dramatic change that led him to get deeply involved in social innovation and community development. He's director of Community Power Fund and founding director of Ontario Sustainable Energy Association, among many other activities. A member of the Windfall team, Jen Atkinson, is director of operations and runs Repower Ontario. That's a training program that educates and connects participants with employment and self-employment in the green economy. Jen Atkinson and Brent Copperson join me live by phone from Aurora, Ontario. Welcome to Career Buzz, Brent and Jen.
Thank you, Mark. Glad to be here.
Hi, Mark.
Hi. Now, thanks so much for joining us today. Brent, what do you like about your career these days?
Well, I think what I like most about my career is I get to go home every day feeling a great sense of accomplishment, and in that the work we do leads very directly to enjoyable careers for others, and on the ground, the work we do is directly leading to improvement in our environment within which we live, particularly with respect to the work we do in energy efficiency and renewable energy and greenhouse gas emission reduction.
And in your career, we've been exploring people's careers and the strengths they use in their job or their career. What strengths do you use that make you successful in your career?
Well, I'm a little bit unusual, I guess, for an environmentalist, and some would say an unlikely environmentalist, in that I came out of the Schulich School of Business and had a prior career in through multinational corporations and companies that I started myself, if you name one, Backstage Pass. But so I've used those business skills in order to create the kind of organization that Windfall is, in making very direct contributions to environmental improvement.
Right. So a real combination there. It's applying the business skills into the environmental world.
Really a great combination.
And Jen, what about you? What do you like about your career?
Well, what I like about my career at Windfall right now is that it's very flexible, and I'm able to be entrepreneurial and take initiative where I can draw on my technical skills and my life experience to really help others find new careers, new aptitudes, to make them have a worthwhile personal and professional career.
And what are you doing as part of Windfall?
As the director of operations, I manage the majority of the activities and programs and staff here. And my big project right now is running the Repower Ontario program, including design and facilitation of it.
All right. I'm going to come back to the Repower program because mm-hmm. that's a really interesting opportunity for people to connect to green jobs. Before I do that, what strengths do you use in your career?
I believe that it's a mix of a solid technical background, which I got through my education and some of my previous work experience, but also interpersonal and social skills, working with others, helping others develop within themselves, and connecting them to some new exciting directions for themselves.
Nice. So it's that unique combination of both the interpersonal, the people skills, and the technology skills.
Absolutely.
And Jen, how did you get here? What's the key turning point that brought you to this point in your career?
Well, unlike Brent, I guess I was always headed or destined for a career in the environmental field. I grew up eating dirt, playing with Lego and riding my bike, and I was drawn to the environmental and nature side of things. I followed the typical direction of heading to university, because that's what everyone did at that time, and I started out with environmental science. I quickly learned that that atmosphere didn't have enough experiential learning for me, and I switched to a college program, ecosystem management. And that started really the turning point for me, where I learned about sustainability planning, about systems thinking, about solar and renewable energy and permaculture design. And that those are the words we hear now, the buzzwords that people are always looking for. So 10 years ago, 12 years ago, now these are being drawn upon in the work I do now. And I started volunteering with Windfall to get started.
Yes. It's so interesting to hear you say that you left a university program to go to a college program. There's so much talk in this province and across the country about the value of post-secondary, especially the value of a university degree. And most people think that's the pinnacle of education. And yet you switched in this unlikely trajectory into the college program. How did people react when you left university and got into a college program?
I think in my circle, it wasn't unexpected. Sitting inside four walls learning from a textbook wasn't really my style of learning. I need to experience to get hands-on, and I needed a direct path to a job. I didn't have the luxury of spending 4 or 5 years, you know, in the university experience. So in my circle, it was sort of a smart choice for myself.
Right. And how did the job with Windfall come about?
It was an interesting evolution. I received a phone call from a college friend who wanted my help in designing some kids programs for the annual ecology festival, and I had never heard of Windfall. So I showed up to help her. She was nowhere to be found, but I met Brent and one of his team members at that time and started volunteering. After a lengthy volunteer placement, I worked my way in, and I haven't left. It's been 8 years.
Great. Thanks for that story. It's so great to hear that the volunteering opportunities can, in fact, lead to really satisfying career positions. I know many listeners have been volunteering, and there's that important message to hear that it can, in fact, lead to great career opportunities.
Absolutely. I highly recommend it.
Brent, how about you? I said in the intro you had an earlier career in a totally different field, running an entertainment merchandising company and other things before a dramatic change. What happened in your story that led to that change?
Well, my story, even prior to my work with Backstage Pass, I was working for a large U.S. multinational aerospace company and flying literally all over the world in my job, and I couldn't help but notice in the flying that I was doing that every time I would fly over a major city, there would typically be a yellow pall that hung over the city. And as the years went by, it was just getting worse and worse and worse. I'm also a private pilot, and at the time I was doing a lot of flying, and I would notice it over Toronto, and it would just kept extending and extending every year. That started my interest in what was, you know, my quest to find out what was happening with the atmosphere, and which led me to issues of climate change, where I spent some time on my own, just learning what was happening. I left that job with the aerospace company, founded a new company in the entertainment business, and operated that for 10 years, and got involved in things environmental, doing some projects with the likes of Friends of the Earth, and on a couple of things in connection with rock and roll artists. And so that sort of got my interest up in both the things environmental and the atmosphere. And then I had a dramatic or traumatic experience in that there was the company was a victim of crime, a very large embezzlement from the company that essentially flattened the company. It put 75 people out of work and led to the dissolution of the company. And I was completely flattened myself from a personal basis, financially, and a career basis. And I was at a place where I really had a clean slate. I wasn't really too sure which way I was going to go. So I needed to spend some fallow time, and I actually, instead of going back into the corporate world, I got a job working as a landscaper in a cemetery.
Wow!
Which is the provided me with the space I needed just to sort things out.
Can I ask you about that change? And I appreciate you sharing this very dramatic story. After this situation happened with the embezzlement, and you know, so many people might go into a tailspin. They might be emotionally so drained from it that they wouldn't be able to reach back into themselves and pull out of that situation. For any listeners who maybe have gone through some equally traumatic situations, what can you share about what it was that you drew on to help you through that very difficult time?
Well, I think that for me, it was, you know, the obvious path for me was just to get up and get back into the corporate world and go into a place where I had existing knowledge and experience. But I had become just very disillusioned with that environment, and I needed a place to, as I said, have some fallow time. And I just knew that in order to reinvigorate myself, I needed to have that space, and I needed to get reconnected with the earth, if you will, basically reconnected with myself. And I wanted to be outdoors to do that, because I'd spent the last 10 years on an inside job and flying around all over the place and always on the go and always on the cell phone. And I just decided that I was going to go work outside, and I just came to the conclusion that a cemetery might be a great place to rebirth.
And what did you learn? What did you experience as a landscaper in the cemetery?
Well, I learned how to how to slow down, and I had time to organize my thoughts. And I essentially came to the conclusion that for me, what I wanted to do was work on something that would actually leave a legacy. And in my prior career, I had done some interesting things, but really nothing that that left any kind of legacy. And I was, you know, traumatized, I guess, about the extent of this the crime. And I wanted to do something that couldn't be taken away. And I had this interest in the environment. And I said, well, if there's one thing that I could do, if I could make a difference, even a little difference, every day in terms of environmental improvement, then that's something that could never be taken away. And I just decided one day, sitting under an apple tree having my siesta, that it was the environment where I was going to go, and I was going to use my skills to help make some changes with the climate crisis that we're in.
And it's a big one that you picked. You didn't just pick a small thing to make a difference in. It's a big, the environment and the climate change, they're huge areas.
Well, it is today, but it's interesting. At the time, there weren't a lot of, you know, in the mid-80s, there weren't a lot of people talking about climate change. And back then, it was just this monster thing that was happening, and nobody was aware. And I thought, this is a worthy place to spend time.
We're talking to Brent Copperson and Jen Atkinson here on Career Buzz. They're with the Windfall Ecology Center, and I'm your host, Mark Franklin, here on Career Buzz on CIUT 89.5 FM. Jen, can I return to you? You had mentioned earlier the Repower program, and I know many listeners are curious about green jobs and the green economy, and we hear a lot about it, especially at election time here in Ontario. First of all, what is the Repower training program in a nutshell?
Sure. Repower Ontario is a orient, train, and connect program that we've developed. It is online and in class. And it's for people who are in transition, looking to really get involved in the green economy. And people in transition may be those who are in a career and looking for more growth. It may be people who are looking for a first or second career. And we have people from all walks of life who come together to learn about their personal aptitudes, transferable skills, and where their new opportunities are for themselves in this growing sector.
So you mentioned the kinds of people who go in, you said first career and second career. What kinds of people, or maybe give us some examples of people who've come in? Where have they come from? Have they already done college or university programs? Or if it's a second career, what kinds of backgrounds have they come at this program from?
Great question. Our classes are very diverse. So we'll have a single mother looking to go into the workforce after a long leave, sitting next to a highly skilled engineer who's a new Canadian, to that new graduate who may have great schooling and very little job training itself. So those are sort of some of the people that you'll see going through this program.
And what kind of outcomes can participants expect? You talk about employment and self-employment. What have people done as a result of participating?
Well, I'll just give you a couple quick examples. We have alumni from our programs who are working in big organizations like the Ministry of Natural Resources, the Lake Simcoe Conservation Authority. And then we also have individuals who've gone to start their own small business, a solar company, for example.
And when you say a solar company, like what kinds of things are they doing? Is it solar panels, installation? What kinds of things?
Yes, solar installations, design, building the solar industry.
And what kind of, what does it cost to participate? What are the parameters of the program?
Well, there is a fee to participate, and the rates vary. We also have scholarships available for people who may have certain income needs. So we try to make it as accessible as possible. Right now, we're looking about a $500 fee for the course, and it can be online or in class so that we can try to meet your needs depending on your time availability.
Right. If listeners do have comments or questions about this, and I know there's so many people with questions about green jobs and opportunities and training, give us a call if you have a comment or a question. You can join us online here. The phone number is 416-946-7000. And you can, sorry, it's 946-8328. 416-946-8328. Or you can drop me a line at mark@careercycles.com or on Twitter, it's @careercycles with a comment or a question, and we can bring you into the conversation. We're talking to Jen Atkinson and Brent Copperson of the Windfall Ecology Center, a nonprofit social enterprise focusing on building sustainable communities. And I'm your host, Mark Franklin, on Career Buzz here on CIUT 89.5 FM. Brent, you've been deeply involved in the green economy. And here, the Repower program is one piece of helping people connect to the green economy. What is driving the growth in the new green economy?
Well, a lot of different things are driving the growth. On one level, it is policy, changes in policy that we're seeing around the world today in response to the climate crisis. So we have various jurisdictions introducing new policies that are giving impetus to the development of renewable energy and energy efficiency programs and water protection programs. So that's one of the main drivers here in Ontario. We have the Green Energy and Economy Act, which has really gone a long way to creating a lot of development in renewables and energy efficiency in Ontario. And we're seeing other kinds of drivers by just businesses looking to make themselves more productive by reducing costs. And energy is a very significant component of most manufacturing processes. So the extent to which you're able to create efficiencies in your production processes, you are at the same time making a direct contribution to environmental preservation. So a lot of businesses are doing it simply because it makes economic sense.
So the program like Repower that's part of Windfall, how does that fit into those larger concepts about the growth in renewables and energy efficiency?
Well, it's a really good question, because really when you talk about the green economy, it's not just those businesses that are directly making solar panels and the development of wind farms. Really, there are opportunities for every kind of business in the green sector, because every business has an interest in reducing its carbon footprint, because when you do that, you save money and you make more profit. So what we're seeing is just about every kind of business that you can think of in one way or another has some stake in the green economy and the work that they're doing.
Now, the policy in Ontario that you've mentioned in the Green Energy Act, we've been hearing lots about it for some years now, but especially because of the election. It was supposed to create 50,000 Ontario jobs. How's that been going, according to your perspective?
Well, I think it's been off to a great start. I think you need to understand that the Green Energy Act is a seminal piece of legislation in that it is a really stark point of departure in terms of how we build out our energy system in Ontario. And it really has created a model for other jurisdictions throughout North America, and I would have to say that Ontario is a leader right now. I was just out in Nova Scotia. I was asked to come and speak there, where they have introduced similar legislation that was inspired by Ontario's Green Energy Act. So in terms of the employment growth, I think the three-year target was 50,000 people employed in the sector. I think we're probably, the latest stats that I saw show that we're sitting at 20,000 new jobs. So we're well on the way to getting there. There has to be a certain amount of patience because these things do take time. It takes time to set up new manufacturing facilities. And there's been, I think, to date, about 51 new manufacturing facilities set up in the green sector. So, things are starting to happen very quickly. There have been certainly some setbacks in terms of the debate that's going on at the political level, with some parties promoting the green energy and others not. And it's interesting that it has become an election issue, which I guess we're going to see the results of on October 6th.
Right. Well, let's just have a look at that. I mean, just with the debate on yesterday, what do you see at stake here for the green economy and related job creation with the upcoming election and the various choices that Ontarians have?
Well, I think Ontarians are faced with some very important choices, but I think overarching what we need to look at is what's happening in the rest of the world first. And the rest of the world is building out their renewable energy resources in a quite rapidly. Wind energy, for instance, is the fastest growing form of electricity production on the planet today. So regardless what is decided in Ontario, renewable energy will continue to grow because it makes economic sense and environmental sense for that to happen. So regardless of what the politicians say, we're still going to be building renewable energy because we're going to need to. That said, we're coming up with some stark choices from in our own energy sector in Ontario, in that we have a need to create new generation, and we have a couple of different paths we can follow. We can build out our energy system with nuclear and coal-fired, fossil fuel-fired facilities, or we can choose a renewable path. Either way, Ontarians are going to be spending billions of dollars or investing billions of dollars in new infrastructure, regardless which way we go. And I would say that a renewable path is the one that makes the most sense, and it's the one that modern societies around the world are choosing. So if we have a choice to make on October 6th, and the polling shows that an overwhelming majority of Ontarians would choose to continue to develop renewable energy, and whether you're a new Democrat voter or a Liberal voter or a Conservative voter, I mean, even among Conservative voters, the majority who traditionally vote Conservative are in favor of the development of renewable energy.
So it's a bit tricky in that Ontarians saying they're wanting to continue the path of renewable energies, even though some of the political platforms suggest that it might get a change in what has been going on with the Green Energy Act and the tariff that allows for organizations to plug into the grid.
Well, we have a system in place. It's one that's been the most successful around the world. And frankly, the kind of program that was introduced by the Green Energy Act Its core element is the feed-in tariff program that that engages communities and business in building out an electricity system. It's the most successful policy that has been used around the world to promote the rapid development of renewable energy, and it has been effective where we find liberal governments presiding over the economy or conservative governments presiding over the economy, as is the case in Germany, which is really the world leader in the development of renewable energy, and that's presided over by a conservative government. And the country now that is building more renewable energy than anybody, interestingly enough, is China, a communist government.
Isn't that interesting? China is building more renewable energy.
And under this kind, a very similar kind of policy.
Really interesting. I could talk more about it, and I know that the community power projects, Brent, that you've been working on are also an interesting development. Can you just say a tiny bit about that? I found that quite fascinating. For instance, on Georgina Island in Lake Simcoe, there's a community power project. And if listeners are curious about that, it seems to me there's a connection there between people who want to work in that field and these kind of growing community power projects. How does that work in a nutshell?
Well, yeah, it's a growing field, and it's made possible because of the nature of renewable energy. For the last 50 years, we've been building our energy infrastructure based on monolithic mega projects in terms of the construction of, for instance, nuclear power facilities and large coal burning and fossil fuel burning facilities that require a very centralized system of distribution and transition. Well, renewable energy is very different from that because the sun shines all over the province and the wind blows all over the province, some places more than others. But the technology is very modular, so and can be erected and installed quite quickly. It actually only takes about 2 days to erect a wind turbine, and it can take 15 years to build a nuclear project. But when you have this ability, the technology to be able to distribute the generating sources around at the micro level, the small level, it all of a sudden means that individual communities and individuals themselves can be part of the electricity generating process. So as a homeowner, I can put solar panels on my home and I can produce perhaps in some cases all my electricity needs by doing so. And to the extent that individuals and communities are able to get together and do that, we really start to create a very distributed and secure form of electricity generation.
And what kinds of people would work on that? If people, say, had done the Repower program, or maybe they've done some other environmental or engineering program, what are those kind of roles that people would play in the development of these kind of community power projects?
Well, they're the typical, I guess a good example would be the Puckwith Community Wind Park. That's a 20-megawatt wind park that Windfall Ecology Center is developing. It's in the northern part of the GTA. We're in partnership with the Chippewa of Georgina Island First Nation. So here we have an environmental organization and a First Nation community who is developing a 20-megawatt wind farm. To put that in perspective, that's enough electricity to power about 7,500 Ontario homes. And so there are engineering jobs, there are community organization jobs, there are legal jobs, there are technical jobs, and there are very basic construction jobs as well. The interesting thing about it is when you have a community project, you end up doing more of your hiring locally, and when you do that, you tend to create a community economic development model that's quite successful because more money stays within the community where you're developing the project.
Right on. We just have a moment here to wrap up, and I wonder if I could return back to the personal stories that you shared at the beginning of the interview, and just based on your own experiences in your careers and lives, if you could each respond to what you've learned about making good career and life choices from your own personal situation. Jen, can I start with you?
Absolutely. So good career choices have to follow along with passion. So you need to be able to be authentic and passionate in what you choose to do. At the end of the day, you spend the majority of your time working, and you need to feel valued and involved and impassioned about what you're doing.
Great. Thanks for that answer. That's inspiring and passionately spoken. Brent, how about you? What have you learned about making good career and life choices?
Well, ditto with Jen. If you want to be happy, then you have to go with your passion and not take too many diversions in life. A great musician, Randy Bachman from the Guess Who, when asked once what would he do if he wasn't a rich musician, and his answer was, "I'd be a poor musician."
Great story. Thank you both so much for joining us here on Career Buzz. If people want to find out more about what you guys do, how can they find you on the internet?
www.windfallcenter.ca.
Great, and I'll have that link on the Career Buzz page of the Career Cycles website. Thanks so much, Jen Atkinson and Brent Copperson, for joining us here on Career Buzz.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Mark.
You've been listening to Career Buzz. It's CIUT 89.5 FM, and we're going to take a musical break. We're going to go to a song by a new piece of new music by PJ Harvey called The Color of the Earth.
Hello, listeners. Do you like listening to radio? I certainly do. That's why when I'm lounging at home in my beanbag, I like to tune into CIUT 89.5 FM. Cup your ears. Now release. You're listening to independent artists from all across Canada. Close your eyes. Now open. You're now hearing the news that affects your community. If you love your radio and want to be heard, then become a member of CIUT 89.5 FM by donating to the membership drive October 17th to the 23rd. For more information, check out www.ciut.fm. Anything is possible if you're a member of CIUT. I'm a dolphin.
From the roots up. CIUT 89.5 FM, broadcasting live 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
From Hart House,
University of Toronto.
We're back at Career Buzz. I'm your host, Mark Franklin. Before moving on to our next interview, I want to let listeners know about the Enriching Lives and Careers in Nicaragua, a unique service learning experience put on by Compañeros and Career Cycles. A free info session is coming up next Tuesday, October the 4th, Tuesday, October 4th at 5:30 p.m. at the Bea Managua Nicaraguan food restaurant, Bea Managua, that's 872 Bloor Street West at Ossington in Toronto. Check careercycles.com for details. When is it time to move up, and when is it time to move out? When is it time to adapt your style for greater success? Bruce Hazen asks these questions as leader of Three Questions Consulting. His own career story spans many areas, from electronics to financial services, from footwear to education, and from community services to engineering and outplacement. Bruce Hazen joins us live by phone from Portland, Oregon. Welcome to Career Buzz.
Good morning.
Thanks, Bruce, for joining us here. What do you like about your career?
A lot of things. This has been a career that I've put together and built over time, which I think all of us do, building on experience. But what I love most about it, it allows me a chance to use a sense of humor combined with, I think, my basic nature of being a therapist and an extremely intense listener. And
great.
I get to do that on a daily basis to the benefit of other people. Humor, good listening, good stories, and helping is about the best recipe for my own career happiness that I could imagine.
Great. Now, what's a day in the life of Bruce Hazen look like?
Boy, it could be a lot of different things. When I heard you reading off the list of different industries that I've worked with, it's exhausting. It's a lot of variety, and that's what a typical day looks like for me. It might start out working with an individual client going to work and before perhaps going to a job that they're not sure they want to keep. It might be followed by a meeting with an organization leader in the afternoon, a coaching assignment, helping somebody really develop a better fit and a better feel for their leadership role. And it might end with facilitating a professional association meeting in something I call an experiential exchange, where we really get people in the room answering each other's questions about career and the concerns or the aspirations, frustrated aspirations people have had about their own career. So a day could be that contain that much variety, and hopefully does contain that much variety.
Well, I like that term, experiential exchange, and I want to come back to that in a few minutes, especially the three questions that you've focused on in your work. But take me back, Bruce, and help us understand your quite peripatetic career story. And there were so many things that I said in the intro here. Can we kind of get a quick tour of what happened, starting in the first chapter, and if you could zero us in on a couple of key turning points, where does the career story start?
Well, the career story for me started with being about as typically brilliant as most 17-year-olds are when I decided that I probably wanted to be an architect. I did a little bit of research into that and discovered that architects had to go to college for 4 years, probably do a fifth year, then do a very low-paying or no-paying internship, then take a rigorous, grueling licensing exam, followed by getting a beginner-level architect job that pays almost no money. As a 17-year-old, I looked at that kind of a career strategy and thought, you'd have to be crazy to do that. So instead, being the brilliant strategist that I am, I went to college for 4 years, went to graduate school for 3 years in clinical psychology, did a no-paying internship, took a grueling licensing exam, and got a starter job for almost no money.
Sounds like parallel universes there.
Exactly. But the difference was, for me, is I recognized at an early age, the one true insight I think I did have, is that my personal makeup wasn't geared for a lot of math and technology.
Yes.
And as a consequence, my interest steered me closer to what my gifts are, I think, and that is closer to be a therapist. But in the role of therapist, I rapidly saw bigger problems beyond the individuals I was dealing with, and I was drawn into management roles, program leaders, executive director roles, and eventually ran a family crisis center and a runaway shelter for youth. And while I was working there, I noticed that a local engineering firm, a very large global engineering company, was advertising for a job for their internal director of employee assistance counseling. And that had been an area that I always wanted to take my combination background of industrial and labor relations as an undergraduate degree and my graduate degree in clinical psych and bring them together somewhere in a work setting. And my opportunity appeared 5 miles from my office. I interviewed for the job, and it brought me squarely into the business place to do what I did best, but in a very sophisticated global engineering organization.
What kind of needs and demands came up inside that engineering firm in terms of these kinds of employee assistance problems that one hears about?
You know, they were as varied as if you could imagine a small town that had, well, maybe not that small, a town that had 4,500 people living in it, and these 4,500 people all happened to be in one building. And all the kinds of issues that come up with substance abuse, family problems, children that run away, marriages that fall apart, bosses that seem irascible and unmanageable, and employees that seem irascible and unmanageable, all of those things were the kinds of issues that people became both frustrated with and concerned that they had no one to talk to about it in the workplace, except perhaps me, because my services were ironclad, guaranteed confidential. And so I remember one of the biggest problems that confronted me early on, in the course of about 2 weeks, half of the legal department came to see me with concerns about the chief legal counsel. And I finally realized that I was sitting on top of a mountain of information about an issue that was bigger than any one of those individuals, and that the only responsible thing to do was to talk to the general counsel. Now, I've been working for the company for less than 6 months and had to sit down with probably the second most powerful corporate executive and explain to him that without changes in his management style, he was likely to lose half of his legal staff. So no pressure there, but a chance to stretch some skills of my own. But it actually began a perspective of learning how to intervene at a management level and how to think organizationally, not just individually.
What happened with this guy, with the person here, the chief counsel?
To my pleasant surprise, he was first shocked and a little embarrassed, and initially tried to very good-naturedly find out, well, exactly who were these people that were complaining?
Yeah.
And I explained to him that there was absolutely no way he would ever know the names of the individuals, but suffice it to say that there were enough of them that if they all left at the same time, he would have a pretty large recruitment problem on his hands. That was enough evidence for him to say he had to take this seriously and had to really look at how he was assigning work, how he was driving people into extra hours, how he was basically promoting and rewarding people. And, in fact, the entire thing calmed down without a single attorney resigning.
So nice. That was one of your first big career management interventions, it sounds like.
Exactly. Exactly. And it helped me understand, too, that some career issues really can't be resolved satisfactorily on an individual basis.
Yes. So what happened after that? Is that the job that then led you to start your own consulting practice?
Oh, God, there were so many twists and turns that came after that that actually became the basis of experience for what I do today. What happened after that is I was recruited away by a company, a consulting firm that provided outsourced employee assistance counseling services for businesses all over the country. And I became the director of the largest employee assistance program in American education. We provided employee counseling services to 34,000 employees of the LA Unified School District. And that the scope and reach of that job really moved me into the role of manager and firmly out of the role of being a therapist anymore. Mm-hmm.
If listeners aren't familiar with this idea of an employee assistance program, in fact, you know, some listeners may even have an employee assistance program that they don't even know that they have or could access. Can you just explain in a nutshell how that works?
Sure. A company that recognizes that their employees have a full range of personal issues and problems that they bring to work with them every day, those kinds of companies recognize that that's going on, and it definitely impacts an ability of an employee to stay focused, to feel engaged, to feel they're able to concentrate and do productive work. So a company will hire an employee assistance provider to set up a confidential counseling service available to employees and their family members to address any of those personal concerns on a short-term counseling basis, maybe 3 sessions, 4 sessions, 6 sessions. It's free, confidential, and it's designed to help you get early access to a counselor that can help you think through or work through a personal problem and get through it and back to work, able to focus and be productive.
Great. great. Thanks for that overview. We're talking to Bruce Hazen here on Career Buzz. He leads Three Questions Consulting. He's talking to us from Portland, Oregon. I'm your host, Mark Franklin, on CIUT 89.5 FM here in Toronto. Bruce, let me come back now to the three questions that, I think listeners are kind of curious about this. In terms of managing one's career, and it's tricky because there isn't a generally well-understood way to manage one's career, and you've zeroed in on the three questions. First of all, what are the three questions?
Three questions that really describe how we manage our careers over a lifetime are, number one, answering the question, when is it time to move up in a career or a job or an organization that you really do like? How do you put together a development plan? How do you move up? Nobody can survive in a career at one static level for their whole life. The second question is, when is it time to move out? When the work doesn't fit you anymore, when the organization doesn't fit you anymore, it's important to know how to move out and when, because, again, no one can exist in one job throughout their entire career. And then the third question applies very often to people in management roles. The third question is, when is it time to adapt your style? Meaning, you're in a job that you like, and you notice that you're not getting the kind of success or the traction that you really want in this job. And it's not everybody else's fault. You know there's something you need to change about how you approach the work or how you approach the role of leader. And that third question is what a lot of the management coaching is about that I do.
So can we look at those questions? Because they're all really quite relevant questions for everybody, I guess, and that's your point. You've even called your company Three Questions Consulting. When is it time to move up? Let's say you're involved in something, or let's say that a listener here is sort of in either an organization or in a field that they kind of like. But like many people, they feel like they're stalled or they want to move forward. They're just not achieving as much as they want to. How do you know when it's time?
Well, there's another question behind that one. The first question, I guess the answer to the question initially is, when you start to sense that you've plateaued, that there's other people around you perhaps that have moved on or moved up, and that the work is starting to become repetitive and relatively easy to the point of maybe even boring. Now, recognizing that maybe the next move is one to advance to the next level of complexity in the work or to the next level of leadership, recognizing that is one thing, but if you've not laid any groundwork, the worst thing you can do is simply raise your hand and claim that you need to be promoted. That's unlikely to play well with most leaders above you. So a lot of the work I do with folks at that level is to help them look at, let's say, acknowledge that, yes, it is time to move up, and what kind of planning, what kind of strategy do you need to design, and what kind of specific actions do you need to take to make that possible?
And moving on to the next question then, when people feel like, you know what, I don't want to move up, but there's something else that either interests me, this question of moving out. And lots of people feel that, you know, it could be any age or stage in their career. What are the trigger points, again, for the move out, and then how to do that?
Well, I'll tell you, Mark, this is the question that I find most frequently the problem question, meaning it's the hardest one to face if it really is time to exit, and it's also the one that most people, I'd say if probably 25% of my clients come to me eagerly attempting to answer the wrong question, and if there's going to be a question that's most frequently the wrong one, it's this. And by that I mean, They've come to me at a state of frustration, and the frustration may be about a range of things, but it's become so aggravating to them that they sort of have one hand wrapped around the ripcord, and they're ready to pull it and bail out. They just want me to help them identify where they should bail out to. And what we often wind up doing is kind of pulling back and looking at their reasons for wanting to leave. And sometimes the reasons are premature or naive, and there's really other things they can do. But
so it might in fact be one of those situations where it's asking the wrong question. It might be time to adapt their style, in fact, when they're just in reaction mode because some problem has arisen in the workplace and they say, I got to get out of here.
Exactly. And most frequently, it involves, let's say, the premature decision to exit is usually attached to some interpersonal frustration they're having with a boss. Occasionally, it can be because they are in a section of a company or their work is attached to a service or a product that's going away. And it doesn't necessarily mean they have to leave the company, but they may need to leave that part of the company. And that's why I encourage people, if they're going to go into a larger company, think about that as an enormous resource, meaning a larger company allows you as an insider to apply for or even create a next job for yourself somewhere else inside that work culture. And so sometimes that's the alternative strategy to exiting. It's moving within the corporation, within the government bureau, within the social service organization they're working for. But when it really is the right question, when exiting is the right question, especially in an economy like this, it can be a very daunting realization. And at the point that exiting is the right thing to do, that's when we put together kind of the classic job search strategy.
Right. Now, we're talking to Bruce Hazen here of Three Questions Consulting on Career Buzz. I'm your host, Mark Franklin, on CIUT 89.5 FM. If you have questions or comments as we're going through this interview, and if you have responses of your own to these three questions, please either give us a call, and you can join us live online. It's area code 416-946-8328. 946-8328, or alternatively, drop me an email. It's mark@careercycles.com or a Twitter post @careercycles, and we'll get your comment or question on the air. Bruce, moving to that last question, when is it time to adapt your style? And I think this is the one that's maybe relevant to the story that you were telling us about the general counsel person at the engineering firm. What are the triggers that lead people to ask that question? And are they asking it, or is it everybody else who works around them who's asking that question?
Yes. Well, it can go either way. And sometimes, as an organization might approach me for assistance, sometimes a person's boss is calling me to say, I have a manager working for me, good talent, but really alienating some of the people in his department. Or I have a woman who's very gifted technically. She's moved into a leadership role. She needs to know more about leading as a specific job. And so sometimes it's the boss calling. Sometimes it's the head of human resources calling. And other times with really insightful individuals, they're calling to say, I can feel it myself. I know there's something wrong here. Or I know I've gotten sideways with my boss too many times in the last month, and I need to figure out a different relationship with this individual. Or I need to step up to the leadership role I've been given. I'm hanging back. I'm not sure what to do next. I'm sort of paralyzed with indecision. I need to get beyond that. And in those cases, what we're really talking about is somebody adapting their style of working, perhaps with their peers, or very often with how they manage up their relationship with their boss or with senior executives in a firm, or perhaps how they manage their own team. And that last question, when's it time to adapt your style, is the one I find it's absolutely essential to have somebody outside of your own head helping you think through and talk through what's going on and bring you the objective insight you need. Otherwise, you get caught in what I call the the mental tornado, where, and this is the mental tornado is very popular with engineers and finance professionals. They're both data addicts. They love information, and they tend to collect more and more and more and more information, but it just spins in their own thinking. And if they're thinking about perhaps an exit strategy from a company, or they're thinking about some part of their style they need to adapt, they just continuously analyze it and collect more data and analyze it some more. And what the job of a coach often is to break that cycle and say, no, we have enough information. You now need to take action.
Right.
And our job is to decide what's the right next action to take.
And whose job is it to answer these questions? You've kind of been talking about the individual asking these three questions of themselves and dealing with it, possibly with an outside coach to support them to break free of this mental tornado. In this world that we live in, especially now, the contemporary world where the economy is full of ups and downs, whose job is it to manage our careers, or at least what's the breakdown from your perspective of the individual managing and developing his or her own career versus the organization who says, kind of like a chess game, you know, somebody's picking up the piece and moving it here and there. How does that breakdown from your perspective work?
Well, Mark, it's a great question because it's the question for our time and for our entire lifetimes also. I really believe people need to be as career self-reliant as they can be. And what I encourage people to do in the book that I'm writing now is to find a trusted other that you can have discussions with about your work. And when that trusted other is either not available or no longer insightful enough, that's when it's time perhaps to find a career consultant, someone who has more depth training in doing this to be able to guide you to the next level. One of the problems that often happens is people wear out the good intentions and wear out the ear of their partner, their roommate, their spouse, their girlfriend, their boyfriend, and someone that close to you who is hopefully uniformly supportive is probably only going to give you a limited amount of objectivity. They have a positive bias, and they may not be telling you some of the things you need to hear. So to the extent you can start the conversation there, great, but find somebody who, as I say, somebody who's willing to express some disappointment in you if you deserve it. If you've said you were going to change something, if you've said you were going to research something and you didn't do it, they're willing to say, you know, I'm a little disappointed. Spending my time trying to help you, and you're not doing anything. So get that person outside of your own head and get that person into your confidence so that they can help you have ongoing, out loud conversations about your career throughout your lifetime.
That's great, a great point, Bruce. Thanks for sharing that. We just have a moment left, and I'd like to wrap up with back to your personal story and a question to you about making choices and what you have personally learned about making good career and life choices.
Hardest decision I ever had to make was to resign a position that I'd been recruited for by a vice president that I really liked, but after working there for about a year, recognizing I was not the right fit for the culture. And what the big lesson learned was not how difficult it was to resign.